when you're exiting Battlefield with Captain Farah Hopley.
As he was in those days, yeah.
He was, yeah.
He's now general.
Yeah.
Yeah, so as I say, he said, smash your weapons, which we did. And the Chinese stopped firing. They could see that we weren't going to put up a fight. So they come down between below and between us, smiling, laughing, and jabbering. And straight away taking personal possessions off of you.
Yeah. What did you feel like at that moment?
Numb. Couldn't believe what had happened. We thought that had we got over this hill, we were out, but had we got over the hill, we still have had about 3 or 4 miles to go. And in those conditions, no way could you do it. You had meat for 4 days, 3 to 4 days. You had a drink of water, 2 hard-boiled of eggs, and 1 piece of dry bread.
You must have been incredibly tired.
Oh, yeah. You managed to cap that. There was lulls in the battle. Going back to the battle again, I get up with a chap called Lofty Large. Lofty is a tall man, and we've got to dig in. Dig your trench. And start digging. Now, he said, right, that's your there. Yeah, can you see? Yeah. He goes down farther. He can see. Then he digs another one down there. A pot. Lofty, what's that for? Hey, bloody hand grenades coming. He said, that's where they got to go in. So, say, fortunate it didn't happen. So, anyway, when we were being lined up by the Chinese and being stripped of our personal belongings, I could see what was happening. And in those days, I had an expanding bracelet on my watch. And sunburnt because it was in April, so very discreetly pushed it up underneath my shirt sleeve. So, I've now got a white mark because of the watch. He grabs her hand and he can see that the watch is not there, so away he went. And the most terrifying thing in my life is to kneel down, put your hands behind the back of your head, and wait. Execution time. That's what we had to do. Kneel down, hands on the back of the head. And he thought, well, when's it going to happen? You know? And that's it. You're actually thinking this. And it didn't. They stood us all up, turned us around, and marched us back to a holding area, which is a picture up there. And met the other part of the battalion that had been killed, captured, I should say. Walking through their dead, they've now started to bring the dead off the hills, and they're piling them some 10, 15 bodies deep. Yeah. Oh, colossal waste of life. Colossal. As they say, there's no exact figure of how many came, but the minimum estimate was 30,000. And of course, indirectly, it changed the face of the war, that battle. If I'm not indirectly, directly, it changed the battle because they lost so many men. They couldn't fight anymore. And I think when they found out that we were British and not Americans, I think we got a little bit, let's say, better treatment when we were captured. Yeah. You ate, slept, and did your body functions where you sat. They wouldn't let you do it. In a holding valley, yeah, you couldn't move. There's a picture up there where they had guards every 3 feet around the tops. The second day of captivity, they decided to feed us. And that was out of their own food pouches that they were carrying, bandoliers of a powder. Let's say a powdered biscuit, possibly, I don't know. But that and water was very nutritious, whatever it was. Yeah, and they fed us individually. And that was the first meal we ever had.
And that was a relatively civil war,
too. Well, no, they were started pushing their weight around at times, you know. When they wanted you to move and you wouldn't move. You know, get up and, well, you're looking at, say, 4 days without sleep, 3 to 4 days without sleep, and no food, but still fighting fit. Probably 4 or 5 days, and then the English-speaking Chinese officer, shall we say, came round and stood there and said, right, we are now going off to the camp. We're going to the rails, they called it rails. They didn't call it camp, rails. We thought, oh, we're going on to a train. And such luck. After walking or marching for 6 weeks, burying our dead as we went, we eventually arrived in a little valley called Chongsung, south of Pyongyang. Empty, no civilians, mud houses in racking ruins, and that was to become the camp.
I mean, that march must have been extraordinary.
Horrendous, really.
Yeah.
They marched as it. Yeah, when they started the march, obviously, we still had very badly wounded men. Some had become ill with dysentery and things like that. And they men were dying, and they marched us during the night and slept by day. Because what they didn't want to know was to let the reconnaissance plane find out where we were. Whether there would have been a breakout, we don't know. But, you would march quite a long time, probably some 6 or 8 hours, and reach the next resting point, which is a building of some sort, primarily a school hall in a village. But then they had to rest, because we found out in the end we were fitter than what they were. Yeah, the Chinese were becoming bad feet, swollen feet. Yeah, and we had to actually rest up for a time, for 3 or 4 days. So the guard that took us managed to recuperate themselves. Yeah.
Was there ever any thought of overwhelming
them all and trying to get away? Or no, when you're one-to-one, I think it's a bit much one-to-one. Several did drop out and escape, but didn't get anywhere. Short was go back to the first, again, vivid memory, in this first place we stopped. They decided to feed us with Korean food, and they bring it in a tin, a rusted tin, something is probably as large as a bucket. It's purple in colour, and is as thick as mud. Eat. Oh, no. This one's come from London. At this moment, it's on, I can't remember his name. Gets up, comes over there, takes a scoopful out. Oh, God, how can you eat that? Oh, he said, when you've been a Japanese prisoner of war, you eat anything. You've been a prisoner of war with the Japs in the Second World War. Yeah. He said, when you get hungry, you'll eat anything. I say to her today, when you are hungry, you eat anything. Literally. Anyway, they decided to come up to this place where, which was the camp eventually. We had to rebuild the houses with mud, which was the standard basic village house in those days, with mud, dried mud, through bamboo canes and different things, thatched roofs.
How many of you lost on the journey?
We estimated overall we lost 30. Yeah. Yeah. There were walking wounded. Chappy shot from the hand, chappy shot from the shoulder, chappy shot from the arm, carrying the ones that couldn't walk. Some died, and we just buried them on the roadside, or wherever we could bury them. And on the march up, when you heard water, don't dip the left-hand side, dip the right-hand side, because the right-hand side's clear, the left-hand side's dirty because you're walking through it. And you scooped down and got water to get whatever you could get up, and take out whatever it everywhere else came up. Yeah.
Did you all get dysentery
and stuff? Oh, yeah. I mean, it was very rife.
You don't want to be fit,
but sorry. No, I mean, dysentery was very rife in the camp. They did bring a Chinese young lady doctor come surgeon to take care of the people that became sick and went up to the temple, which was the hospital. It was a temple, a Korean temple that became the hospital. And if you became really ill, and I mean ill, dying, then they took you away. And then the burial detail would go up there every day and take them up to what was then called Boot Hill and bury them. It was called Boot Hill because there was more Americans up there than there was English. Right. Yeah.
So in this camp, how many people were there?
Well, there was all our group, which was some 600, including officers, NCOs and different things. Then there was our partition, and the rest was Americans.
And they were separate?
Yeah, they kept us separate, yeah. There was a sort of a boundary, if you want to call it. Then they found out that the officers was influencing the other soldiers, so they took the officers away. Then they found the sergeants were influencing the other people, took them away. So we ended up in the camp with nothing above corporal. Yeah. And every day was a routine of going down to the American sector, picking their dead up and taking them up to Boot Hill because they would not bury their dead. They didn't want. They would rob them of whatever they had. There is a story that was, which I believe to be true, that when one particular American was relieved, he had so many gold teeth in his possession, it was unbelievable.
They wouldn't bury their dead.
The Chinese pleaded with us to go down and bury their dead. We had a dried up riverbed with a stream running through it, and we approached the Chinese, come towards settling in, and asked if we could build a swimming pool. So they allowed us to dam the stream up to create a river, and every day after you finish work, or if you want work, you go down to the pool and have a swim. Work consisted of an 8-hour walk. 4 hours out and 4 hours back.
Just
no. Because that was the wood detail. You needed wood to burn in the cooking houses, and you needed wood to burn in the winter to keep the central heating going. The central heating was at one end of the hut in a little outhouse was a fire. The fire flues came under the house, under the floor, and out the other end, and that was your central heating.
Was it effective?
It was very effective. Yeah, too hot. Mm. So we had to go and get up to the mountains and bang back bamboo to build a kang, as it's called, a wooden floor. So many feet off the floor, so you could. Very effective. Very effective. So 8 hours walk out. In those days, in the beginning, we had a guard man. You'd arrive at where the timber had been cut. And the Chinese would say, right, that's yours, pick it up. So he'd look at me and go, some of the fitter ones had bigger logs, so I had a little. Bring it back, chuck it on the pile, and that was it. That was your day done. But that took 8 hours. And when the mill came round, it would either be in the morning or in the evening. You never knew when it was going to happen. And that was one mill a day.
What sort of things would that be?
Mainly consistent of rice. They had soya beans. They made soya bean milk out of it. Cultivated seaweed. And maize. Millet. But the main function was rice.
Was it very
flavorful? If it moved, you ate it. Yes. As I go back again... we'd come through one village on the march up, had this mill, and I said, oh, beautiful. Nice one. I mean, tasted nothing like this before. So Chinese folk come there, saying, chopped, ding ho, very good. Yeah, he's the man chatting away, he's Chinese. And I'm like, woof, woof. We'd have a dog. We'd eat the dog, which is still today. They still eat dog. Koreans still today they do it. Yeah, they eat it. Yeah,
I think the
Chinese
do it.
Yeah, but yeah. So there we was. You can come back and whatever. When you finished, if you wanted to, you could go down and have a swim and keep yourself fit. But what used to get you was the 14 hours brainwashing, occasionally.
That was just occasional, was it?
It was occasionally. It was sort of regular intervals. No wood details. They lecture. And you've got to sit in the the school playground, because in the village there was a school, obviously, but it's been bombed, but there was a big playground, and that was the lecture. And you got there for some 14 hours, being the red book read to you, and lectures going on, and Cat Commander telling how foolish we were to be in the armies fighting for all this and all that. Why not come to us and be a communist and all that?
What effect did that have on the individuals?
Rubbish, we were.
No one.
Oh, yes, you had people.
You
I mean, you've got to look at their politics were probably communism anyway before he went over, but they became communist. Mm. Didn't matter to us because we should poppycocking border dash.
Do you know anyone who became a communist?
He hasn't come back to England.
No, he's still
there. He's still there. But I don't know where he is, but he never came back.
No.
Well.
And did he actually believe it, or was it, you know, he thought it was the best option, the best way to survive?
Well, I think part of it is, I say he probably could have been, whether he was politically minded that way or not, but there were about four or five actually that went over. And
out of 600,
yeah, because when they found out, although we were sat there, we were talking to them, they silencia, keep quiet. In the end, you had to answer questions and say, "Well, what do you think of so and so?" But yeah, okay. Let me see. Was that before the film or after the film? It was one no film. So I think eventually they packed it in. They could see that we weren't going anywhere.
Yeah. What about cruelty? Was there any cruelty?
Oh, yeah.
Like what?
The tin shed. Mm-hmm. Tin shed was there.
Did you see that?
Yeah.
Did you experience it?
Not personally, but Colonel Carr went into it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, in his own way. Yeah.
Was that a threat to everybody?
I think it was, because once they could see it, this was, I say, in the beginning, when the officers were with us, when the battalion was together, the influence was there, so they thought, right, if we do this, then maybe the rest will knock under.
How did the officers behave at first? Did they carry on as officers?
As officers, yes. Yeah, oh, yes. You no, still
did you think that was appropriate?
Oh, yes. If you go back to the bridge, we were quiet. Where the battalion comes to attention and the officers do, which we had to do in the beginning. Because when we were marched, we used to march to the parade ground for starters, when we got for a lecture, they fall us in, true British upper lip, march, quick march, away to go, actual march up to it, and march back to it from there, yeah. Oh yeah, this is why they moved the officers out, because they could see that they were a bad influence.
And when the sergeants were there, they carried on the same?
They carried on, yeah, they carried on the same as the officers, controlling people and saying, you know, if they ask you to do so-and-so, we suggest that you don't do it. And we had a coloured young man in our battalion. Ron Norley, I know his name. I can't remember.
Was he African?
He was American, coloured American. But he was an Englishman. He was a naturalised Englishman. And they thought he was an American. So they tried to ship him down to the American camp. And we said, he's not American, he's English. Well, the interpreter, camp interpreter was in the end, was quite a nice man, because you know, you're talking, you're living with each other for 2.5 years. And we said to him, he's not American, he is an Englishman, he is British nationality. And in the end, he convinced the camp commander that he wasn't American, so he stayed with us. And that was only through protest, because whenever they told us to do anything, we sat down. We just sat down, and they used to go mad. And again, towards the end, they took quite a lot of the guards away, because the ones that escaped were brought back some several weeks or months later, because of the terrain. You're in a valley, no barbed wire, no nothing. You can't call it a prisoner of war camp. All you've got is a road in and a road out, and the mountains, and that was it. That's called Camp Number One.
I mean, on your march up there, but just going back for a second, what had you seen of the indigenous population, you know, the local people? I mean, how were they being treated? You know, were they suffering? Or?
You couldn't tell, because all they did was line a route where you're walking through, and that was the only contact you'd have. they'd stand looking at you. They wouldn't cheer, obviously, wouldn't cheer or whatever, but they just stood looking at, and you couldn't say, oh, well, they poor buggers, you know, but, no, you didn't come in physically. You couldn't stop and talk or do anything. You had to keep walking.
So, once the officers and the sergeants had gone, was there a sort of sense of organisation? I mean, is it corporal?
Oh, the corporals, yeah. A friend of mine, Corporal Ron Norley, still alive. He was a physical training instructor in the Army, so he set up a physical training plan. We managed to get some big logs of wood and cut it up, make dumbbells, and he ran the gym. The young chappie that got shot through the hand was losing the power in his hand, so Ron made him a couple of dumbbells and got all the life back into it again. Yeah. We had camp concerts, men dressing up again as ladies. And somebody wrote a play, and there was a piano, and Frank Perryman was a pianist, and he used to get sheet music from home. It would come eventually.
Yeah.
And when we have a camp concert, which probably once every month, we'd have a sing song, and we had some very good singers. Instead, I've got a very good friend now who can still sing well, Albert. Frank would get up and say, this is the latest music, and the river, what was that? See the pyramids along the Nile. And he'd play it. And said, that's the latest hit tune from home. Yeah. And then you'd go out in your non-working day and go gymnastics or whatever, have a walk round, and just walk the perimeter. You're walking the perimeter, and you've got a sentry using scented soap. Yeah. And as you walk by him, you can smell it. And one of the Ulster riflemen, boy, guard would look at him. Every day this was happening. Anyway, I won't tell the name of the chappie, goes by, and this Chinese guard put a bayonet through his arm. Stuck him with a bayonet right through the arm. He'd learnt he obviously went to the interpreter and said, well, you know, obviously I've got something, keeps on to me. And the interpreter must have told him, well, it's a feminine sort of thing. Bailed it. Yeah. Yeah. Mm.
Well, did you ever see any cases of homosexuality in the camp?
Oh, it's happening. Mm. Yeah. Yeah. You would hear about it. Mm. Yeah. And you'd see these particular people moving around. I mean, there was 10 men to a room, yeah. Head to toe. Mm. And that's all it was, head to toe. You had room to move, but that was it, 10 men to a room. And these particular individuals we would see moving around. They wouldn't stay in their own mouth, so yes, it was happening.
And what was the general thought about
it? It was accepted. The people who went with those people, you know, they're homosexuals and that's it. So, but being the main road through the camp, obviously civilians used to walk through. Because it was the pathway, like. And this particular day, we sat upon the top row, and this figure comes through the camp, and I'm looking at him, and he's halfway through the camp, and somebody said, "That's Far Ockley." Nobody says it. "That's Far Ockley." And but before he got out of the camp, they nabbed him. He'd escaped again. 8 times he escaped. 8 times he got captured. So he gave up again. He was dressed up like a Korean with a dirty old Mackin sack and that all over him. And obviously he got past the guards coming into the camp. And the guards must have tweaked something because they got excited. Like, we got excited. And they got him before he went out. And then they brought him back through the camp. Everybody had cheered him, but did it with him any good because he'd been caught again. Yeah.
What do you think about that escape attempt?
It was futile, yes, because
you
had everything against us. Lack of food, terrain, and physical features. You couldn't stand out anywhere, wouldn't you? Yeah. And they used to bring them back, they say, oh, so-and-so's gone. So-and-so's gone. And if you stood up and said, called herself lecturer, I've been a bad boy, I shouldn't have done this because the Chinese are good people, load of bull. You go in the box for a couple of days, in the box, and then come out again. But unbeknownst to Chinese, when they escape, they would say, I shouldn't have gone down 437, I should have gone down, I couldn't go that way or whatever. And they were telling you where to go, indirectly. So, but it stopped in the end. And everybody just accepted that it was too far to go. You're up, just outside of Pyongyang, which is almost into China, and you've got to go all that way. Happy in as much that you were alive and you were fit. If you call 6 to 8 pounds fit.
No,
yes, no fat. Physically fit. Talking and reminiscing and different things. The greatest thing to talk about was food, obviously. Roast beef, Yorkshire pudding. And roast potatoes, because you couldn't stomach what was going to be put up for you. And unfortunately, people that did die stopped eating.
And what was that? Was that through depression, or do you think that was just through they couldn't bear the food?
Couldn't bear the food. I mean, as I said, a bit more you ate it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, people
so what
say
things did you eat apart from what you were doing?
Maggots, yeah. Fish. That shrimps out in the fridge, yeah, different things. But in and weevils that was in the maize and things like that. But when you came back off your wood detail, and if the meal was in the evening, you could eat a horse. But what you took, you had to eat. You couldn't say, oh, can't eat no more. You had to stuff it down and get rid of it. Because if you didn't, they didn't like that. In the end, we did our own cooking. Christmas, we had chicken, pork.
Really?
Yeah. You had in our particular little cookhouse, we had one chicken between 40 men. So that was cut up in pieces and put into a stew. Pork was done the same. Still had the hairs on it because it was wild boar. But you can give my monkeys about that as well. Cut it down, yeah. But as I say, basically the rice, and then they brought European bread. We will bring you your bread for you to eat. Put through that window, it'll smash the window. I'm not moldy, it's my window, but it's hard as rocks. So we used to put it in the steamer and steam it and eat it, yeah. But basically, boredom was probably the worst thing.
Yeah. I mean, the people who stopped eating, what was done about it? Did people try to...
Force-fed. Yeah. This is where the... No. Chinese wouldn't bother with them.
Right.
If we found somebody was a bit delicate, they would take the rice away and water it down, make it into a sort of a broth and things like that. And this is where the home cooking came into it. Can't remember his surname. I can remember his name. Preston, tall bloke, Ted. His wife was very active in cooking. The most succulent beef, the most succulent roast potatoes. Yeah.
And I used to tell you about that.
Oh, used to. This was a regular thing. Sit down and have a chat, and you had an appetite, but it was. Yeah.